Okay, welcome everyone to today's Art Chat, Elements of Nature from Field to Study with Joe McGurl and of course your host, Linda Fissler. My name is Sarah Alstall. I am the Online Education Manager here at SNW, and I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Quick note that everyone is in listen-only mode, and that just means that you're muted so we don't pick up noise from your end. However, there is a question section on your GoToWebinar control panel, and you can type questions in there as they come to you for Linda and Joe, and we'll have some time at the end to answer those. All right, so without further ado, I'll turn things over to you, Linda. Welcome, guys.
Hi, thanks, Sarah, and welcome everyone out there. And should we call it Art Chat Land? That wasn't really corny. I don't know what it is, but welcome everybody. And today we're going to be talking with Joe McGurl. And I've talked with Joe a number of times. I actually, in a very loose way, consider Joe to be one of my mentors because I certainly, follow his work and I certainly analyze his work very closely, as close as I can, on computer screens. And Joe and I have had a number of conversations about different philosophies with art, that, you know, kind of how he looks at things and how I look at things. And I'm actually looking really forward to studying with Joe 2 days down in Carolina, North Carolina, in Raleigh, at the Jerry's Artorama's Art of the Carolinas. Joe's doing some workshops, and if you've ever wanted to study with Joe, this is a great opportunity to do that. I know his Saturday workshop is sold out, I believe, but his Sunday still has some spots, and we'll talk a little bit with Joe about that as we get into the broadcast. But first, I just want to say welcome to Joe. So I'm so glad you're here, Joe.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me, Linda, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you, and for all of you out there listening, thanks for lending me your ears.
Yeah. So the first question that I had sent to you, it's kind of like a loaded question. I just read it, and I'm sitting there thinking, my gosh, there's like four questions in that one question. So let's start off with, we may have some new listeners out there. Some probably followed us over from our old Art Chat program and are very familiar with you, but I'm not sure if we've got, that whole audience, but we may have some new folks out there as well. So tell us a little bit about your philosophy about living an artist's life, being an artist, creating art.
Well, that's a big question, but I'll see if I can sort of dissect it a little bit. Living an artist's life, it's, for me, it's, you know, amazingly rewarding, and it's something I knew I wanted to do ever since I was probably about in kindergarten, 5 years old or so. My dad was an artist, so I was sort of exposed to it at a young age. Then I did the usual, went to classes on Saturdays through high school and went to art college. When I got out of art college, however, I realized that I really didn't have a good grounding in traditional representational drawing and painting methods. So I sought out this man at the Guild of Boston Artists, Robert Cormier, who was a wonderful teacher, and he taught me sight-size figure drawing using charcoal and the French Academy methods. And that was a really big turning point in my art, because I was able to slow down and really spend time drawing a line and getting that line to be exactly where it had to be, not sort of close. And I wasn't trying to be expressive and such. I wanted to try to recreate that line that I saw with as much accuracy as I could. Hmm. And I spent about 2 years with Bob Cormier drawing the figure, and it really turned my art around and set me on what I consider to be the right path for me, which was representational art. And I've been doing it ever since. I've been a full-time artist since I was about 28. About that age, I could quit all my other odd jobs and devote myself solely to painting.
Hmm. Yeah. So, great. So 28 is when you basically just said, okay, that's it, I'm going full-time, I'm going to start painting. Is that when you started painting more plein air as well as in your studio, or?
Well, the plein air is interesting. I obviously when I was a kid, every now and then I'd take my pencils and paper outside and draw something. But when I was in college, I had this teacher, and she encouraged me to go out and paint directly from nature. It was one of the few really good pieces of advice I got in college. She was actually a pretty good teacher, very demanding, and I did this painting in class, and then afterwards we talked about it, and she said that I should go outside and paint from nature. So I did. I bought this big wooden suitcase type of plein air painting kit. It wasn't a pochade box or anything. In those days, it was a very heavy wooden box with legs that attached to it that I could open up. This was in 1977, I believe. And I painted this painting of a sort of a derelict building that was near where I lived, and I just loved it. It was like really something that I grabbed onto and I connected with right away. So I've been painting outside in plein air pretty devotedly since 1977, quite a while.
Wow, yeah.
And then I've sort of developed this process where I paint outside to understand nature and become more aware of how it interacts with the different elements. And then I bring my sketches back into the studio and develop studio paintings from the plein air sketches. So the sketches are really a way for me to understand nature on a sort of a physical level, how the different elements interact, and also make some type of spiritual connection with the landscape that I'm portraying also. And then I can bring them back and rearrange elements. And a lot of my paintings are actually made up from my imagination now, but they're based on years and years of painting from nature. So I'm able to pretty much paint what I want with enough fidelity to nature that it's believable. I call it just being within the realm of possibility. And so, people look at my paintings and they look like nature, basically. And that's my goal, to have them recreate the feeling of being in nature, even though the actual scene doesn't exist anywhere except for in my mind.
Okay. Well, we covered a lot of things in there that we're going to dig deeper into. But before we go into there, I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about the Art Renewal Center in New York City. I know that you've got some connection to that, and if not that, I know there's the whole principle that we've talked about before about not so much classical realism, but actually taking your art to a whole new level, and how I guess you could say being a commodity is kind of hurt it, I guess, is kind of a way we can say it. I know you'll help me out with this. I'm kind of fumbling with some words. But first, tell us about the Art Renewal Center.
Okay, the Art Renewal Center is a terrific organization. If you aren't familiar with it out there, you should probably go online and type in Art Renewal Center, and you can find all about it on the internet. It's an online organization, and they're dedicated to bringing back and preserving representational art. They're based in New York and New Jersey area, and they have a large salon competition every year with several different categories, and they get a couple of thousand people entering the competition. They have an extensive website with images from historical and contemporary artists and high resolution, and so it's a pretty active organization. They have a news flash that they send out maybe a couple of times a week with different things that are going on in the representational art world. So it's a good way to connect with the wider world of representational painting, and it's also an excellent way to gain access to hundreds or thousands of images, high-quality images of artist work. They also have some articles that are in the archives that have been written over the years on subjects relating to representational art and such. So it's a really a pretty dynamic organization. It seems to be growing each year. And I would encourage you all to check out their website and become a member if you like. They have, for artists, they have different categories of membership. There's a living master, associate living master, and I think artist. So there's three different categories that you can become a member of at the Art Renewal Center if you're a practicing artist. Yeah, so it's check it out.
Okay. So, and then do you have any organizations that you work with there in Boston as well, or is I know that you had been associated with a group there.
Yeah, there's the Guild of Boston Artists, which is a group of artists from New England, and we're actually celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Guild of Boston Artists. It started in 1914, and some of the early members were Tarbell, Paxton, Frank Benson, some really terrific turn-of-the-century American painters. And it's on Newbury Street. It has a gallery, two floors, and it's a beautiful old building right in Newbury Street. And we often have different shows, theme shows, guest shows, and sometimes different types of events. A speaker will come and such. So it's a nice organization. I've been a member for about 25 years.
And great. I'll give them a little shout out. So
and I'm also a member of the Plein Air Painters of America, which is a national organization. And it's made up of painters who are dedicated to painting in the field. And it's, I think it has the finest plein air painters in the country or members of it. So I'm really proud to be connected with that organization. And we had just had a painting trip in Colorado where we were there for a week painting up in the mountains in Colorado. So that was terrific.
Oh, gorgeous.
And,
Okay. Just, I think our discussion of different techniques and things that you do will highlight to everyone your commitment to really creating, you know, exquisite representational artworks, pieces of art. It's just, when I look at your work, it's just amazing. I went, Sarah, do you have some of his work that we can? I'm not getting any on my screen, so I'm not sure if you were waiting to put some up or.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry, I didn't share my screen. Can you see it now?
Yes, I can.
Ah, there we go.
So now that we're going to get into, it's there. So now that we're going to get into. Talking a little bit about the elements of nature discussion, which is one of the workshops that you're going to be talking about down in North Carolina. Again, one-day workshop, and you know it's going to limit how much we can really get into this. So I'm sure your own workshops out in Cape Cod are much more extensive on this. But just talk to us a little bit about the elements of nature. And I know there's this whole conversation that artists tend to have in themselves that, you know, don't think of it as painting a tree, think of it as painting shapes, and there's all that whole discussion that goes in there. So tell us a little bit about the elements of nature and some of the techniques that you use, and we'll go from there.
Right. Well, when I go out and I'm painting in nature, I first spend a couple minutes sort of analyzing what I'm seeing. And I always have in the back of my mind that I'm creating form on a flat surface. So whenever I paint something, I'm always thinking form, and the form is described by the light. So I'm also thinking of light. So they work in conjunction with each other, where you want, without light, you won't have form, and if you have no form, the light isn't going to hit it. So you need those two things working together. There's also an order to nature that you have to kind of understand. But you also have to realize that there's a competing chaotic element with nature. So you have order and chaos competing with each other. For instance, if you were painting the ocean, the waves have an order. There's sort of a height and a direction that they're flowing. But if you make them all exactly the same, it's going to look like one of those little cartoon depictions of the ocean. So you have to put in a little bit of chaos, which means a little bit of variety, breaking up the order a little bit. The same with a tree. The branches have a system, but if you follow the system too perfectly, you'll have sort of a child's depiction of a Christmas tree, for instance. That's the order, but then there's chaos thrown in, and the chaos is created by a lot of different factors. For instance, if you have a tree, it could be a windy day and a branch breaks off, and the prevailing wind makes the tree lean a certain direction, and also maybe the direction of the sun, and there might be an adjacent tree that's shading part of the leaf, so you'll have an asymmetrical distribution of the leafage and such. So you want to look for the order, underlying order in nature, but you also want to add in this sort of the element of chaos. For instance, back to the ocean, if you're painting the ocean, you'll have some larger waves and some smaller waves, maybe a couple of waves close together, rather than have them all evenly distributed throughout space. The interesting thing is when you go up high, like if you're in an airplane, suddenly things become very orderly once again. Even a chaotic mountainous landscape, when you look from a plane, you look down, and you can really see the order that nature has arranged. However, there is still that chaotic element. So you want to balance those two features. And then you come to the actual process of rendering, and how do you make a rock look like a rock and a tree look like a tree and such. And there again, I go back to the form. You have to look at the overall form of these objects. For instance, a rock, a tree, and a cloud. They're very different elements, but they all have a form. They have a top, sides, bottom, front, and back. So you want to create that effect of the three-dimensional form. You're always thinking, this is the side, this is the top, this is where the most light is coming, this is where the least light is coming. And when you do that, you're able to create this sense of depth and space and form in your paintings. I also use a lot of different tools in order to apply the paint. And because nature is made up of so many different elements, if you use the same brush throughout the painting, you're going to get a similarity in edges and marks, and where a tree may lay against the sky, for instance, is much different than how a wave would crash on a rock, or a calm body of water would meet the sand would be different. So I use a lot of different tools. A palette knife is always at my disposal. I use that all the time. And I have these rubber wipeout tools, they're called, where it's a rubber nib, kind of, and you can carve into the wet paint. I use a lot of glazes, and I use scumbling. The scumbling is when you put an opaque pigment on top of a glaze. And a glaze, of course, is a transparent layer. So my paintings will have several layers of glazes and scumbles back and forth, getting the right degree of transparency and opacity in the different elements of the painting. And because all the elements in nature are so different, I want to also paint them in a different way on my actual painting. So a sky will be handled much differently than the land would be. And then I can sort of break it down a little bit further into different ways I handle different aspects of nature.
Right. No, it was great. I was like, I'm still saying, wow. Some of the things that, like, when I teach, I'll typically teach from the viewpoint of trying to get my students to get away from thinking about a tree and start thinking about a different shape, like the trunk is a cylinder and, you know, the top of the tree could be considered a sphere, and then, of course, you use negative space to cut that back and give it some kind of shape. And, of course, I say a sphere instead of a circle because a sphere is three-dimensional where a circle isn't. You know, so there's all of that conversation. And is that how you started out and then you just kind of dropped and went away from the front back, if we just use a cube, for example, you know, the front, top, and back, and just started going, well, every shape has that three-dimensionality, so you don't try to categorize them into a specific type of, four shapes, cones and spheres and stuff.
No, I don't consciously anymore because I've been doing it so long, it's sort of ingrained in me, but I think if you're starting out, it is helpful to always think of these sort of geometrical shapes when you're painting nature, and that helps to simplify things in your mind a little bit. But for me, it's if I'm painting a tree, I'm conscious that I'm painting a tree. Some artists say that they just paint shapes and colors and edges. But for me, it's really important that I'm painting a tree because I'm going to look at that tree in a different way than I would a rock. I'll handle it differently, and psychologically and emotionally, I'll feel about it differently than I would feel about, you know, a rock or a cloud or a car or whatever it was I was painting. So for me personally, it's already sort of ingrained in me that, you know, this object that I'm painting has form, and I don't really have to, in my mind, simplify it because I already sort of do that subconsciously. But for an artist who's starting out or who's struggling with that, I think it is easy if you forget about the tree-ness a little bit and just look at these shapes. And if you copy that shape exactly, it's going to end up looking like a tree. So it's really a matter of drawing. And if you can draw accurately, painting is much easier. A lot of artists, I think, they jump into painting too soon before they've really acquired the required drawing skills. And that's where the figure drawing I did with Bob Cormier was really instrumental, because it made me a much, much better drawer. And you really have to be a good drawer to paint the landscape. People think you can be sloppy, but you really can't, because it gets sloppy. Suddenly the shapes don't fit together, and the recession of planes doesn't work. It doesn't look like it's going back in space at the right angle and such. So it's, you know, it is really important to be a really good drawer when you're painting landscapes. And figure drawing is a good way to do it, because it's easy to tell whether an arm is too long, but it's hard to tell whether a tree limb is too long. However, if your tree limbs aren't well drawn, eventually they catch up to you and it just doesn't look like a good looking tree. It's, you know, an awkward looking tree.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I credit you for, and why I think of you kind of as a mentor, because before this, I really didn't pay that much. Well, you and Joanne Arnett, I have to say, I have to give Joanne Arnett credit on that too, because she's always talking to me about drawing as well. But, you know, it really did hit home between the two of you when we're talking, because my paintings have gotten, and I can see, and people react to them too, how much stronger the paintings have gotten when I pay attention to of the painting. And to me, the early stages of the painting is drawing and value, what values I'm going to put where, and how, you know, basically, like all the masters, paint with, you know, maybe 3 to 4 values, and doing all that analysis up front really helps you in the end. I see everybody kind of rush through that first couple, not everybody, but I see a lot of people rush through those first stages because they want to get to the color, or they want to, you know, they want to get to those exciting shapes.
Right.
And that really does, I think, hurt a lot.
Yes, because structure, oh, go ahead. Well, the underlying structure.
No, I was just going to say if you have anything to add.
Yeah. Yes, the underlying structure is really important in a painting, and if that's wrong, it doesn't matter what you're going to do with the color, because you're never going to be able to fix it. A lot of times when I start a studio painting, I'll do a brown and white grisaille underpainting, and I'll make sure that I get the composition locked in and the drawing really accurate before I even put on any color. And I also am able to tell whether it's going to be a successful painting, because, you know, in a way, the color is kind of the icing on the cake. And by doing the underpainting, I spend quite a bit of time at it, and I'm always thinking, considering, and determining whether it's worth investing a significant amount of time in this painting. So by the time I've got the underpainting all locked in, I can, you know, I really have a pretty good idea of where the painting's going and how, you know, what are my struggles going to be as I proceed through it. But you can't hide bad drawing with color, and so it's, if some of you out there are not familiar with sight size figure drawing or even cast drawing, you can Google it and find out how to do it. And that's a really good way to improve your drawing skills. It was devised by the French Academy, or perfected by the French Academy, I should say. And in the 19th century, all the artists knew how to do sight size figure drawing. And it's a really good way to train your eye and become a better landscape painter.
Well, that leads us into telling us about the sight size method. Because you spend so much time drawing and naturally out in nature, studying nature as well as painting from nature, do you think that both of those methods provide you with the means to create the final painting to the point that you don't need photography? I know your memory comes in here a little bit too, but is it because of those two methods particularly that you use?
Yeah, but it's mostly my philosophy too, where my philosophy really doesn't align itself with using photography. There's a whole host of reasons that really aren't so much sort of the nuts and bolts aspect of it. But the biggest reason is that I'm painting light. And if I'm going to paint light, I have to paint the real light. I don't want to paint a photographic depiction of light, because light is composed of photons, and a photograph doesn't have any photons. It's pigment I would be matching were I using a photograph. But if I'm painting light, I'm actually painting photons, which is much different. And I guess that I'm also, if I'm painting a mountain, for instance, I want to be painting the real mountain. And a photograph of a mountain isn't the real mountain. So it's, in a way, it's almost like idolatry, where the photograph is standing in for the real thing. And that doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. For some artists, it's fine, and that's not their concern. And you know, that's great. They're doing something different than what I'm doing. But for me, I have to paint the actual object. And even when I'm making something up, I'm making it up out of memories and plein air sketches that I've done over the years that are derived from the actual objects, from real nature and from real life. So it's really important for me to have that strong connection to the actual thing I'm painting. I also have a, you know, this belief that there's some spirituality in the landscape, and they've, you know, the answers to the universe are all to be found within nature. And by working directly from nature, I feel like I'm much closer to that question of, you know, what is life and what are we about, and, you know, what's the meaning of life and such. And working from a photograph, I feel, would diminish that connection that I feel and that closeness I feel to that question about, you know, what are we doing here, and how does this all fit into the big scheme of things. So it's largely a philosophical issue of why I don't use photographs. But on a practical issue, I don't need them. I can paint as well from a photograph or as from life or as, you know, from my memory. My biggest issue now isn't being able to render nature and make it look natural and somewhat real. It's, you know, getting ideas and inspiration and meaning in my painting, rather than just sort of the nuts and bolts, the rudimentary aspect of trying to make a tree look like a tree and the ocean look like an ocean. That's not an issue for me anymore. And part of the reason it isn't is because I've been painting from nature rather than photographs, because photographs can give you a kind of a kickstart, but then they diminish your development, because you're not out there struggling. And the struggle is where you learn the most. When you're out there painting a tree and it's just not looking like a tree and you can't figure out why, instead of taking a photograph and going home and copying the photograph, you're better off sitting in that field and struggling through that tree and figuring out what you're doing wrong. And then you can use that later on when you're creating a tree out of your imagination, or if you're repainting that tree. It's like the old deal, if you look up a word, you remember what it means. If someone tells you the definition of a word, you kind of forget it in a couple of minutes. So it's the struggle that, mm-hmm. you know, that's where you really learn things, is your failures. And you want to fail, because that means you're pushing it and you're doing something that's difficult and you weren't able to do before. And so you want to have a lot of failures in your art. And sometimes people with the photograph, they get so worried about failing.
Well, no, this is like, there's a couple questions that, like, when you're teaching a workshop and you say, you know, no photography and making things up, do you hear a lot of gasps? Like, no photography. I'm not going to survive.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think when people understand my reasons why, they, you know, it kind of makes sense. And there again, it's something that works for me. It doesn't work for everybody. So there are some people that, you know, that's the way they work with a photograph, which is fine. It's, you know, a different method than what I use, because their philosophy is different and their goals are different. If you're, you know, if you're painting light, for instance, it's hard to work from a photograph and say that you're painting light, because a photograph has no light. It has pigment, but there's no inherent light in the photograph. So for me, the light is really important in my paintings, you know, spiritually and on a scientific realm. It's, you know, it's a photon, which is, as I said earlier, is much different than a pigment that you would find in a photograph. But yeah, some people, you know, they're like, oh, no photographs. But if they want to use photographs in, you know, in a workshop that I'm doing, that's fine, because they're doing something different for me, but I can still help them with you know, a lot of the issues that we both deal with. As I said, it's mostly a philosophical reason why I don't use photography. And it's also...
And when you say something like making something up, you're making something up within the boundaries of what you have studied for since you were 28 years old, right? I mean, it's like, it's not this make something up like I'm going to put a fairy in here or a dwarf or something. This is, you know, I know what a tree is supposed to look like because I've studied a tree, and I know what the ocean waves look like, and, you know, I want a wave over here, or I want to put a tree over here, or that's the kind of making up that you're talking about, right?
Yes. Like the image that's on the screen right now, it's a winter sunset, and that whole scene was made up. But it was made up of things I've seen. And a lot of my paintings are, I call them a combination of empiricism, rationalism, and emotionalism and imagination. And the empiricism are the things that I observe when I'm out in nature. And the rationalism is when I'm making a painting like this winter scene, I have the little puddles of melted ice. And I say, okay, well, here's the puddle of melted ice, and there's a sunset behind it, so it's going to be reflecting in the calm water. And then here's where the hillside comes in, so the hillside will be reflecting in that calm water, and there's a little tree off in the distance, and that'll be reflecting. So it's sort of this logical rationalism that's based on things that I've observed, the empiricist part. So, you know, that's sort of how I construct the painting. And then there's also this emotional content. Like with this painting, I was trying to create sort of a melancholy end of day, midwinter feeling, where it's kind of a cold and, you know, just this real feeling of melancholy. So it's kind of a combination of the, you know, those different elements that come into the picture. But when I make things up, they are based on reality and based on things that I've seen and experienced and such.
Is it fair to say that other than what you described with, you know, how light's going to be affecting the different elements in your picture, but it's more for strengthening the composition and possibly the feeling that you want to bring out in the painting as well?
Yeah, it's both. You know, they have to work hand in hand. I want to have a strong composition and something that's a little bit compelling for the viewer to experience. And you can do a lot with light in that regard. But also it's, you know, I want to have it portray some emotional aspect too. And for instance, this winter scene, I want to try to create the feeling that there is brilliant light just over the horizon in the distance. And in a way, it's kind of a little bit of an optimistic feel that it's not all doom and gloom and melancholy because there is light somewhere in the world. And so there's a lot of meaning to the light in my paintings, as well as it's used, you know, obviously for compositional purposes also, and to create a mood and atmosphere and such.
I had a question for you, and then it like popped out of my head when I was listening to you. But staying with this particular painting, how thick is the paint on this painting, Joe? Because it's rendered so beautifully. If we saw this in person, would we see texture in this?
Yes. In the foreground, in particular, there's a lot of texture in the branches and the brush and such. And I believe in the it's been a few years since I've seen the painting, but in the snow, there's quite a bit of texture in the snow. It's fairly heavily painted. And then there's some glaze laid on top of that, and then some scumbling on top of that. So there's several different layers of paint. Most of my paintings have, you know, probably average 4 to 8 different layers of paint on it, each doing it, you know, having a different purpose. Sometimes just because I painted it wrong and I have to repaint it the right color. Particularly when I make something
this is like
I sort of feel myself along if I'm making a composition up because, you know, it exists in my mind and I'm trying to imagine how it would look. And oftentimes I don't know where I'm going, but I know when I'm in the wrong spot. So, if you know, I can never really plan out my paintings in advance. it's just sort of a series of corrections. Well, that doesn't look right. I've got to lighten it, or I've got to darken it, or I've got to change that shape. Because a lot, if I'm not working from a sketch, it's kind of in, you know, new territory, and I'm making nature up as I go. If I'm working from a sketch, oftentimes it's much easier because I have the answers there, rather than trying to invent the answers and make them, adjust them so that they look somewhat natural.
Yeah. This is a totally selfish question, but at your workshop, are you going to have some of your work there for us to look at?
Probably not originals, because I'll be flying in. And so I'll I'll plan our sketches. I'll have several plan our sketches, 9x12.
Okay.
But I won't have any large originals, because I'll have to get them on a plane, which won't be very practical.
Okay.
You have to take
you ship them to me, and I'll bring them down. Ship them to me, and I'll bring them down, Joe. Wink, wink.
Yeah. Gee, window. Where are those pants?
Oh, darn, I forgot it. Let's go back to your whole process, and let's start with out in the field. In your plein air painting, I think you just kind of answered that. You do basically 9x12s. Do you sketch first before you actually start doing anything on the canvas or canvas board?
It varies depending on the complexity of the scene that I'm painting. Sometimes I'll do a brown and white underpainting, sometimes with acrylic. And if it's a hot day, I'll do the underpainting in acrylic very thinly, set the panel out in the sun, let it dry up while I get my other gear ready and my paints all set. And by the time I'm ready to go, it's all dry and I can paint right on top of it. If it's something that's a little simpler, then I'll just go right in with the oil color. And in particular, if it's something that the effect is going to change really quickly, if I'm painting a sunset or cloud shadows and such that are constantly moving, I don't want to delay things by doing the underpainting, so I'll start right in. But usually I'll do an underpainting, and I work site size. And if you look at the screen, there's an example of a site size painting on the screen. And that means that I paint the elements that I see the same size that I see them. I don't enlarge or reduce the scale of the parts of the painting. And if I get my colors right, my drawing right, when I line it up to the scene, it should somewhat blend into what I've painted. And on the screen, this is a painting of a wall that I did in Italy. I actually was looking out the left side of the panel, so if I should have moved the whole panel over to the left, and the perspective of the wall would have matched a little bit better what I painted. But I just sort of snapped this with my cell phone at the end of the painting, just out of a curiosity. But you can see that I've matched the colors fairly well, and the drawing is pretty close. So in a way, that's, you know, that shows that I really don't need a photograph, and a photo wouldn't bring any more to the scene than I've already painted. So in a way, it would be just sort of this extraneous information that I really wouldn't need. But when I painted the 9x12 landscape on site, then I can take it back to the studio and decide whether I want to make a larger version of it or not. And I may alter some of the images, some of the shapes and the composition, or I may just use it as a completed sort of 9x12 sketch, and it's just a standalone painting in its own. So it really varies. And sometimes I'll have a painting that I've worked on, you know, several years ago, and I'll drag it back out, and I've got a good idea of how I can make it into a larger painting or use some of the elements, maybe the sky or trees or a mountain shape, for a painting that I can base it on sort of loosely. But yeah, I almost always work in 9x12 because it's a standard size, so it's easy if I want to do framing. And also, it's not too big that I can't get enough ground covered before the light changes, because we're all always fighting the time out there, and light's changing really fast, so we have to paint sort of fast. And being from New England, the weather's never consistent enough to go out 2 days in a row and work on the painting the next day. Years ago, I used to do large paintings on site, and I had stacks of half-finished painting waiting for the light to be the same. And where I was painting on the coast, then the light would be the same, but the tide would be out, or my calm reflections were now all, you know, ruffled from the wind. So getting consistent weather in New England was really difficult. And that's when I decided to do the 9x12s on site and enlarge them, make larger paintings from them, rather than doing the large paintings on site.
Do you sell your reference photos, or are they completely yours and you hardly ever share them except for maybe at workshops, and you just have the stack that you use all the time, or do you do sell them and post them and share them with the world?
Yeah, a little both. Some of it myself, you know, this is how I make my living, so I have to account for myself somehow. So if they come out well and they're, you know, just fine standalone paintings, then I'll also offer them for sale. However, in my studio, I do have stacks and stacks of half-finished paintings that really didn't come out all that well, but there's some element that I want to maybe refer to in the future. So there's some that I keep that, you know, I don't really show people because they're not really finished paintings and not what I would consider really works of art. They're sort of studies that have elements in them that are of interest to me, but they don't necessarily make a good painting. So, yeah, it's a little of both. But I do have to, you know, put some of these out for sale because that's, you know, that's the nature of the game. I'm an artist and I sell my paintings.
Exactly.
I also actually,
so tell us.
Oftentimes, before I sell them, I'll make a Xerox copy. If you go to a really good copy shop, I'll bring the painting in and put the actual painting down on the screen, and adjust the color and the value, so I get an amazingly accurate copy of the painting. And then I can keep that and refer to that in the future if I want to be able to use the sketch and also sell it. So that works out pretty well.
Wow. I wouldn't have thought of that. Yeah, okay. I want to actually prompt our listeners that if you all have any questions at any time, type those in, and Sarah will be keeping track of those. So if I'm not catching something that you want to know about, please feel free to type in a question so that we can ask Joe here in a little bit about those as well and get your questions answered. Let's, with this image that we still have on the screen, because I think it may be a good one to do this with, Joe, can you talk to us a little bit about the tools that you use? Maybe start out with the paints that you use. You said you use acrylic to start out with, but your oil paint brands and what kind of canvas that you're using, and then talk to us a little bit about your brush versus palette knives and where you might use some of those tools.
Sure. Well, I paint on a panel. It's either a masonite panel that I coat with gesso, or it's a panel that I've bought commercially that has linen applied to it. And I'll often put another coat of gesso on the linen just to obliterate the grain of the canvas a little bit. I also like to have a little bit of texture in the canvas. And as I said, I paint 9x12 or 6x8. Usually those are the two sizes. Years ago, I used to paint in all these crazy sizes because I was an artist and I didn't want to be constrained by the man giving me standard sizes. But then I realized that this is silly, because if I need a quick frame, I could never get one because I was painting a 13x17-inch painting when I could have done a 12x18 or something and had a more standard size. So I usually paint 9x12 and 6x8. The paints I use are generally Gamblin. I like them because they're stiff and there's a lot of pigment in them. And I'm not really, I don't like soupy, buttery paint. I like really thick paint because I can always thin it down if I have to, but it's hard to make thin paint thicker. So I try to find the thickest paint I can and something with a lot of pigment quality into it. I use a little bit of medium. Lately I've been using, or for several years I've been using liquid impasto, which is sort of a thick gel medium. It dries fairly quickly. And for white, I have a special thing that I do that has really enabled me to carry my paintings to a much higher degree of finish. I use this underpainting white. It's made by Winsor & Newton. And in the field, it sets up in maybe like 10 or 15 minutes, meaning it gets super tacky. And you can paint on top of it, and you can keep applying layers of paint without it getting like you're frosting a cake and you just can't put any more on it. So this gets really stiff and allows you to keep putting layer and layer on top. And you can actually dry brush it a little bit. And on a hot day, I've actually put a glaze on top of the paint. You get maybe one shot to make a pass if I wanted to make a certain part of the painting a little bit darker. I could mix up a very watery glaze and paint it right over what I painted. So it's a really terrific paint for outdoor painting. Some people don't like it because it's really stiff and hard to move around. But I also have regular titanium white on my panel, and on my palette rather. And I use that for if I want to have a little bit more finesse with the paint and I want to put in some details and such. For my colors, it's basically a warm and cool of each color. I'll have, for instance, a cadmium yellow deep, which would be the warm yellow, and a cadmium yellow pale, which would be a light yellow, the cool yellow. And, you know, the palette is just basic colors. Generally speaking, as bright as I can get, because it's easy to dull a color down, but if you have a dull red, it's hard to make it brighter. So I have pretty much the brightest colors I can, and then I can always tone them down to a duller color, a duller chroma. For my brushes, I have a sort of a ragtag assortment. I have a lot of, I call them scruffy brushes. They're brushes where I've cut the ends off kind of ragged, like a really bad haircut. And years ago, I was struggling with trees where I was trying to make the trees have these natural organic edges, but I had a square brush. And it suddenly dawned on me, why am I always fighting the square brush? Why don't I make my brush as sort of ragged and as organic as the things that I'm depicting? So I got out my scissors and I made this real ragged edge in the brush, and suddenly it got so much easier to be able to paint trees and, you know, bushes and all these natural organically shaped feature that we find in nature. So I have maybe three or four of those scraggly brushes of different sizes. And I also have a fan brush, a couple of fan brushes. One is a bristle, it's a little bit stiffer, and the other is a nylon that's much smoother for blending things and softening things. Just a little bit in the field. Sometimes it's nice to just take the edge off of something. If you have a really sharp edge that's jumping out and a little bit disturbing, I'll run the fan brush over very quickly. I'll also have a couple of rigger brushes, which are really thin brushes for putting in thin lines and little details at the end of the painting. And I have my rubber wipeout tool in my paint box, where it's that rubber nib that I can use to carve back into the paint if I want, carve into the wet paint. And it kind of smears the paint rather than blends it. So I like to use that for certain effects. And the palette knife is probably the most important tool that I have. I use that all the time when I'm painting in nature. And the good thing about the palette knife is, where I was talking before about the order versus chaos, the palette knife is good for putting a little bit of chaos into your painting, because you can sort of control what it does, but it also does this random, these random marks you put down that you really don't know what you're going to get. And oftentimes you get these unique shapes that you could never make up. They're just really, you know, unique to the palette knife. And then I'll finesse it with a brush a little bit. So if you think of the brush as putting in the order and the palette knife as putting in the chaos, I'll have them in one in each hand. And if I'm painting a tree, for instance, I'll use the start off with the brush to sort of block it in. Then I'll take the palette knife and give it a little bit of chaos, these little strange marks that only the palette knife can make. That sometimes it comes out a little bit too chaotic, so I'll take the brush and I'll put a little bit of order back in with the brush. So it's working back and forth, trying to find a balance between order and chaos. And so the palette knife is really good for that. It just makes these marks that you would never be able to recreate with a brush. There again, giving more variety in your landscape, because the landscape is full of variety. There's so many different surfaces and textures that you're trying to recreate, you know, everything from clouds to rocks to grass to trees to, you know, tree trunks, and just this huge variety of surfaces. So the more variety you have in your brush marks, the better you're able to replicate what you see out there in nature. And that's about it for the tools in my box and kind of how we go about painting the planar landscapes.
Cool. I paint a lot with palette knife, and one of the things that I like to do with it is kind of hide that. Like, if I look at your paintings, they don't look like there's any palette knife in here, and that's kind of like what I go for too, because my philosophy is the last thing I want is a viewer coming up going, oh, she painted that all with palette knife. You know, I want them to get the experience of looking at it, you know, the pull on emotions or whatever it's about, not that they're sitting there and technically analyzing it. That's not important. As artists, we'll do that naturally, but any other viewer, they should not be sitting there going, oh, I really like your palette knife work, you know. And I've had a number of people come up and say, you know, I like your brush work, and I've just said thank you, because how I create it is something that they don't need to know. And I guess from your description about what you were doing, I can kind of feel that same sense with you, that how it's created isn't as important to you as the reaction that the viewer, whether they're an artist or not, is getting from it, right?
Right, and yes, like there are certain paintings that they call palette knife paintings, and right off the bat, you know, the whole thing was painted with a palette knife. And, you know, there's a certain pride among those artists that, you know, they painted the whole painting with a palette knife, which is fine. That's a different type of painting than what I do. I use the palette knife,
right,
not like for the sake of using a palette knife. I use it because it does certain things that the brush can't do. And I also don't want the viewer to be really conscious of how I made the marks and such, because I want them to sort of immerse themselves in the scene. I don't want them to get hung up on the process. But that being said, I also want the paint to be really interesting to look at, existing just as paint in its
yes.
own right. So that's why I use a lot of different techniques and textures and glazes and such, because it is paint, which is a fascinating material to work with. And so rather than painting everything thinly with like one coat, or, you know, not have the paint really express itself, I want to push the paint and get it really to do everything that paint is able to do with, you know, textures and transparencies and scratching. I do a lot of scratching back into the paint. I sand the paint surface. I have a whole drawer full of different tools that make different marks in the paint. I have this crazy roller thing that I got at a hardware store that has these little wheels on it, and I'll drag it through the wet paint, and it makes sort of a striated pattern in the paint. And so I really like to exploit the, you know, the possibilities of the painted surface, but I don't want it to get in the way of the imagery, and I don't want it to be a barrier for the person to enter into the painting and sort of melt into the background. I want them to have sort of a seamless transition through space in my painting. And if the palette knife was too prominent, then you wouldn't be able to do that. It would be hard to get past the technique. So that's why my paintings, even though they have a lot of manipulating of the paint, there's not a lot of brush mark and palette knife mark on them.
The one that Sarah just put up, if you look up at the top, I'm talking with the listeners at this point, you can start to see some of Joe's texture that he does have in his paintings. I just wanted to point that out real quick.
Yeah.
Joe, do you work mostly wet into wet?
A little of everything. You know, in the field, obviously, it's wet into wet, or it's more like wet into sticky. With the underpainting white, the underlying layer is usually a little bit sticky. But in the studio, it's a little of everything.
Okay.
Depending on what I'm trying to do. If I'm putting on a glaze, obviously, it has to be bone dry underneath. But if I'm blending a sky, for instance, it's going to be, you know, wet into wet. And so it really varies. And I'll usually have several paintings going in the studio at once, because I'm waiting to dry. And there may be some paintings where I can only work on for maybe 15 or 20 minutes a day, and then I've got to let it dry and do the next layer and the next step. So there again, just like my technique is a combination of just about everything, you know, palette knife and rubber wipeout tools and brushes and different scraping tools. My process, as far as how I work in the paintings, is really varied also.
Yeah. As far as capturing emotion and in your paintings, this is kind of an out there question, but I'm kind of curious. Do you feel like the artist needs to experience that emotion before they can truly put it into their paintings, or not?
Yes, otherwise it really doesn't ring true oftentimes. It's hard to paint something that you haven't experienced, which there again goes back to my not using photographs. I have to, on some level, at some point, have been able to have experienced, you know, what I'm painting. For instance, the painting that's on the screen now is completely made up, but I spent a lot of time at the top of the Cadillac Mountain in Maine looking at the islands and watching what happens to them in different weather conditions. And there was one day where the islands seemed like they were almost suspended in the sky in the distance because the haze in the atmosphere obscured the horizon line and blended the color of the sky into the water. And so when I did this painting, I was remembering that back, oh, I remember what that really, you know, wonderful effect that I saw. It was probably 5 years earlier. So I made this painting up, but, you know, I didn't experience this exact scene, but I've experienced scenes like this oftentimes in the past. And, you know, when I go over bridges, I'm always looking down at the water. I love going over a bridge and looking out, or flying in an airplane, for instance. I went to Indianapolis last month, and there was a massive thunderstorm as we were flying into the airport, and I looked out the window and I had a little piece of paper, so I scribbled a little sketch with an ink pen and, you know, a writing pen on this little scrap of paper, and I'll probably do a night scene of a thunderstorm from an airplane window, which will be a fun painting to work on. But, you know, the memory is, you know, was really powerful, and I think I'll be able to pull it off because I spent so long just staring out the window at that thunderstorm. So, yeah, it's important for me to experience at some level what I'm painting. For instance, there are paintings I think it would be kind of great to paint, but I haven't had the experience to paint them, so I couldn't do it with authority and conviction and truth, which is important to me to have a high degree of truth in my paintings.
Right. Yeah, I always enjoy looking at them. I'm going to be really excited to see your studies down in November when we're down in Raleigh. That'll be really interesting. I'll probably just stand there for a while and look at them, so just kind of like ignore me.
You'll also be surprised how thick the paint is on the studies, because with that underpainting white,
I'm sure I will be.
Up the paint on the studies also.
Yeah, I can't wait to actually. Unfortunately, when we were together out at the weekend with the Masters, I really didn't get to see anything that you painted because it was just so crazy. But yeah, so this is going to be interesting. I'm going to have a fun time down there looking at your work. So
yeah.
Actually, I think it'll be the first time I'll actually see it in person, because I certainly have seen your work on the computer in different places. So
yeah,
that'll be good.
So
we're coming down pretty much to the end of the conversation where I'm talking to you. Hopefully our listeners will be putting in some questions for you too. But what I would like to kind of end with are two things. The first one is any advice for any of our artists out there who are listening?
Oh, brother, where do I begin?
Do that in like, you know, the next 5 minutes or so, okay?
Right. The biggest advice is just to put in the hours. You know, there's all this talk lately about how it's, you know, it's marketing that gets your paintings sold, and, you know, if you have the right marketing and such. But it's not. It's really just putting in the hours. It takes an enormous amount of time to, you know, to perfect your skills. And it's like any profession. If you're a plumber, you're a plumber's apprentice for years before you're a master plumber. If you're a doctor, you're in residency for years. And so if you're a painter, it takes a long, long time to become good enough to do it. And that just requires a lot of time at the easel and a lot of looking and studying and going to museums and trying to figure out how one particular artist did some type of art that you're somehow interested in. I spent a lot of time at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston dissecting the 19th century landscape paintings. And so it's really... The biggest thing you can do is paint. And there again, I believe that you're better off if you don't use a photograph, because the photograph will get you an initial likeness and a little bit of a jump start, but then it I think really hinders you from learning really about, you know, nature and how to recreate that in paint. And remember, it's the struggle. That's where you learn the most, is the struggle. So you want to have a lot of failed paintings. I had tons and tons. I still do have failed paintings when I'm trying something new and it just doesn't work. So don't be afraid to fail.
You know, I think one of the best compliments that anyone can receive is when somebody's who's not an artist is standing behind you and they say, they make it look so easy. And somebody said that to me when I was demoing a few, actually last week. And I turned around and said, I hope so. It took me, you know, 20 years to get here. It's like a great setup line. And then they kind of look at you and like, you've been doing this for 20 years. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's like, you just don't, you know, you're not born from the womb this way, believe me. And then the other thing is I just wanted you to talk about a little bit about the upcoming workshops down in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I think you've got some other ones possibly coming up as well. And then is there any place where folks can go and see your work?
As I said, the workshops in North Carolina are basically taking your plein air paintings and creating them in the studio and making something larger and better, bigger and better out of them, I guess is the thing. Being able to recompose your sketch to make it more powerful, more impactful, and just much more dynamic. Oftentimes when you paint something out of doors, you know, it's a good painting, but it doesn't make a great studio painting. And so this is going to focus on how to improve that and turn it into a great studio painting, and also some of the nuts and bolts methods that I use to make my studio paintings and give them a little bit more fidelity to nature and closer sort of depiction of reality. So that's going to be the focus of the Carolina workshops. I don't have a workshop in the future right now. I just completed the one that I had here at my home studio in Cape Cod just last week. We just finished up. So around January or so, we'll schedule something for next year. Probably is going to be in early June. I usually do one workshop at my home studio a year, and then I'll do one or two other events somewhere. Like this year, it's the Art of the Carolinas in North Carolina next month. And I did the plein air convention in the spring, and I used to do the Weekend with the Masters workshops when American Artists was doing them. So stay tuned for what I'm going to be doing next year, workshop-wise. And probably the best way to see my art is to go onto my website, josephagirl.com, and check out the events and the galleries where I show there. And it has a...
Okay, you said that really quick, so say that website again.
Oh, it's really...
Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, Joe. I said you said that website.
Yeah. It's really easy. It's josephmcgirl.com. Easy one to remember. Or you can search.
Right, it was just like... just McGirl with it. Yeah, I was like, no. We're going to say this really nice and slow. So josephmcgirl.com. And if you have any questions about, you know, what it is or anything like that, just let us know. You know, send me a note or send Sarah a note, and we can send it out to you. But you should know how to spell his name because I think it was on the front page. It's MCGURL is his last name. Okay, so any exhibitions or anything coming up?
There's one in South Carolina. I can't remember the name of the museum, but that'll be on my website shortly. We've just sort of it organized. And I do have paintings right now at the Idle George Museum show in Indianapolis. I think that show is just about over. I think I have one painting left. It was a show and sale. It was really amazingly successful. They did a great job out there. It's the Idle George Museum of the West in Indianapolis. And at the Sal Magundy Club, the American Masters show is opening up. I think it's the 15th. It opens up. I'm actually giving a panel discussion on collecting art on the 16th of October. And I think the show runs for 2 weeks.
Oh, that would be interesting.
Yeah, it's always a great show. They have wonderful artists there. It's a really nice show for me to be included in. And if any of you are in the New York City area, or you can go online and see the show. It's the American Masters at the Sal Magundy Club. I don't think they have all the images up yet, but they should in a week or so. And let me think. What else is coming up? I think that's about it for shows. In the near future, I'll be scheduling some more as they develop, too.
Right. Okay. So I think, Sarah, are you have any questions for Joe?
We do have a few questions here. I'm going to start with this one from Susan. She asks, any suggestions on simple equipment for oil painting plein air?
Simple equipment for oil painting plein air. Unfortunately, it's a very, it's not a very simple process. You have to try to keep it as simple as you can, because you have to walk with all this equipment, and who knows how far you have to walk. But you know, it's check out the different pochade boxes out there. I just recently got a Strata pochade box, which it's pretty heavy duty. It's metal. It's a little bit heavy, but I kind of like it. They have a mini and a larger size, and I got the Strata mini. It's S-T-R-A-D-A. And I'm kind of liking that. I also have a my own kit. I sort of cobbled together from several different places, and I made a couple parts myself. So don't be afraid to make your own parts and sort of invent your own kit. Don't just buy what's on the shelf and stick with that. If you can make it lighter, that's always good. I use a plastic box. I don't use the wooden boxes because they're just too heavy. So I carry my supplies in the plastic box, and I have a panel holder from Sun Eden Products, which makes these panel holders just attached to a camera tripod, and that seems to work pretty well. And the shelf I made out of a piece of wood, and I attached it to my easel. It's sort of a homemade thing. So yeah, don't be afraid to cobble things together to make it work better for you.
All right. Another question here is, there are so many different types of palette knives. Which ones do you use, and which one would you use for doing graphs up close?
Okay, this is a good question, because a lot of times when people come to my workshop, their palette knife is too short and too stiff. So to be able to really push the paint around without scratching it, you need a palette knife that's maybe 3 inches long, and the tip is fairly thin and very flexible. If the palette knife is too stiff, rather than smearing the paint, which is what you want the palette knife to do, it'll scratch like through to the surface of the canvas. So you want something nice and kind of floppy in the end, and then you can really push the paint around. You can also sort of bend the palette knife as you carve with it. If you have a thin blade, and you can sort of carve in curved shapes with your palette knife rather than just everything straight. So get the longest one you can and nice and flexible in the end. You may want a stiff one for some other effect, but generally speaking, I only have one in my box, and it's about 3 inches long and quite flexible.
As opposed to me, I have six in my box, so, and they're all different shapes.
Everyone's got
this
their
is going to be
thing.
Fun in November, Joe. We're going to have a good time.
Clean up your box.
Oh, man. How do you paint realistic shadows? What colors do you use for a tree shadow on grass?
Oh, that is such a hard question, because I still don't know what the shadow color of green is. Such an elusive color.
It is.
The easy answer is it's darker green, but it's not. There's often different colors thrown in there, and they're going to be affected by, you know, what type of light there is. Is it a really strong sunny day, and other strong colors adjacent to the shadow, they could be throwing some color back into that shadow. It is their haze, and how far are you from the shadow of the tree? So there's really not one answer. You know, it's always completely individual. Every day is different, and every shadow is going to be different from the tree. So I guess the best thing to do is squint at the shadow and try to determine what color it is. And oftentimes it's not just one color. It might be sort of a patchwork of a few different colors. Sometimes I'll look at a shadow and say, geez, especially with a white shadow, a building that's white, say, and it's in shadow, it looks kind of bluish, but nah, it looks kind of tannish to me. And oftentimes it's because it's a little of both. So I can paint it with a broken brush mark, sort of little splots of blue and little spots of gray and maybe a little warm brown. So I'll have sort of a mosaic of different colors on the side of that building. And the same you may find under a tree shadow might have sort of a cool bluish green in part of it, and other parts may be almost a purplish color, and maybe even a little bit brown in there. So that don't pick on one color and say that's the only color there. Oftentimes there's a few different colors in that shadow. But it's a hard question. You know, I'm still trying to figure out the shadow color of green. green's the hardest color to paint, which is annoying because I paint landscapes and there's a lot of green.
Okay, let's see, another question here. I just want to remind everyone, if they have a question, they can type it into the question section on the GoToWebinar control panel. This one is from Linda, and she asks, do you finish one element as you go, or do you tend to work on the entire canvas, finishing it all at the same time?
I work on the entire canvas, generally speaking, particularly since I don't know where I'm going to end up. For instance, oftentimes when you see photorealist paint, they'll start at one corner and kind of work their way across, and one part will be completely done and the other part won't have any paint on it at all. And that's okay working that method because you know what colors you're going to use and you know what your composition is going to be. But with me, it's kind of like I sort of feel my way along. So I'm not sure where any one particular part is going to end up until I get everything covered to sort of the same degree of finish. So it's kind of several steps of bringing everything along simultaneously. And the big issue is when you put a color down, it affects the colors that are adjacent to it. So it's hard to say that the sky is going to be that color until I get the land mass and maybe the water filled in also. And then I may say, gee, the sky looks a little bit too dark for the land or water, so I can adjust that. So it's always a case of like constant adjustment with my paintings. And so it would be impossible for me to work on one part completely and get that finished, because then it would have somewhat of a disjointed feel, because, you know, the sky would be completely finished and then I'd work on the water and get that completely finished, and I'd compare the two and I'd say they don't really work together. So I'd rather get the sky somewhat finished and the water somewhat finished, and then go back to the sky and rework the sky again, get it really close, rework the water, get it really close, and then maybe a third pass, go in and get the sky exact and get the water exact. So I try to keep them all progressing simultaneously.
Okay. Somebody asked if you could repeat the brand of oil paint that you prefer.
Yeah, it's Gamblin.
Okay. And then I also use
Utrecht sometimes, which also seems to have a pretty good stiffness to their paint and high pigment quality.
We also have a couple questions about what's on your palette, if you could list exact colors you use.
Okay. as I said before, they're the brightest colors I can get, generally speaking, and there's a warm and cool of each. So my yellow would be Cadmium yellow or Hansa yellow medium or deep, and then a light yellow would be a Hansa yellow light. The red would be cadmium red medium and alizarin crimson. That would be the warm and the cool reds. For blues, I have three blues. I use brilliant blue, which is kind of almost phthalo, but it's not quite as strong as phthalo. It's much weaker, but it's sort of a warm greenish blue. I use ultramarine blue, which is kind of a purpley blue. And then cobalt blue, which is kind of right in the middle. It's not really warm or cool. For brown, I used asphaltum, which is a Gamblin color. And it's very similar to burnt umber, but it's much deeper. And it's not quite as red. So I can get nice deep browns with that. Green, I generally hadn't been using green, but I started to reintroduce it. So I've got two greens that I've been working on, Viridian, which is a very cool bluish green, and then Permanent Green Medium, which is kind of a medium, fairly bright green. I use Dioxazine Purple, which is a very, very deep purple. I like it because if I want to have a really dark shadow, it works really good, and it's not black, so it has a little bit of life to it. But it's extremely deep. And I do use black, Mars black. And it's funny because a lot of artists have always heard that, oh, you should never use black. But black's great. I use it all the time. And for instance, if I'm painting a sky, oftentimes I'll start with black and white, and that gets me 80% of the way. And then I'll tint the sky with either a warm or a cool blue, depending on the exact color, and I'm pretty much there. So black's good. It saves a lot of time. Mixing colors and deepening colors. You just have to be wise about it. You can't make all your colors dark just by using black, but every now and then it's just the right thing to use. So I do use a lot of black. And then my white is that, the two whites.
But the other thing,
underpainting white and titanium white. What was that, Linda?
Well, I was just going to make a comment about the black. Black and yellow can also make a different variation of green. So
right.
if you're working from a limited palette and black's not on it, if you put black on it for the point of bringing in a different range of greens, it works wonderful.
Right. Yeah, it does. Black's a really good color. One thing I have to mention with the underpainting white is it has to be the Winsor & Newton underpainting white. That's the only one that sets up really quick in the field. The other underpainting whites don't set up quite as quickly as Winsor & Newton. So that's the particular brand that I use for my underpainting white in the field. And that's it for my colors. It's pretty basic, just a warm and cool of each, and that's it.
Okay, I think that was all of the questions we got to. I did want to answer Sherry's question because she joined us a little bit late, and that we are recording this, yes, and you can watch it. It'll be on the Artist Network YouTube page and then also artistnetwork.com/art-chat. And that's where you can find all of Linda's previous art chats as well as links to her upcoming art chat. So if you joined us late or you have somebody that wasn't able to join us and you want to share this, feel free to share the recording. It should be up later today. If not, it'll be up tomorrow for sure. We did just get one more question here. Let's see, hold on. Actually, I'm not. The question is something about the brown color. Oh, could you say the name of the brown color again? It sounded like burnt umber, but they're not sure.
Yes, it was asphaltum. ASPHALTUM. And it's a Gamblin brand.
Okay. Thank you.
U-Track may also have it.
All right. So if you guys have any other questions, send them in at the last minute here. Otherwise, Linda, I'll throw things back to you if you want to talk about your next art chat or anything else that you guys have coming up. That'd be cool.
Yeah, just real quickly for Joe, like I said, a Saturday workshop, the last time I looked down at the Art of the Carolinas, is sold out. His Sunday one still has some spots available. It's if you're in the Raleigh area or the North Carolina area and you can get to Raleigh really quickly, these are actually wonderfully priced workshops. I think it's somewhere around just under $250 to spend about what, Joe, is it about 8 hours with you each day?
I can't remember the exact hours, but it's all day. Pretty much a long day.
I think it's like starts at 8 or 9 and it goes to like 5 or something like that. So if you're looking for a real quick introduction to paint with Joe, these particular workshops would be wonderful. And then you can register for those down out at the artofthecarolinas.com. Just Jerry's Artorama, and there's a link there too that you can get to the Art of the Carolinas page, and you sign up for them there. So that's one thing I wanted to say. The next art chat, we're going to be talking with Lori Putnam. And Lori is one of the up-and-coming artists. She's really come out onto the scene, I would say, in the last couple years. What we're going to talk to Lori about is how she did that, how she started getting everyone's attention and what commitments she had to make her art get to that level. And if you've ever met Lori, you know she's a lot of fun to talk with. So she will be our next show on November 11th. And then in December, we're going to talk with George Gallo. And George has actually a book coming out from North Light Shop. And we'll talk to George about his book, and we'll also talk to him about his color selection and expression and things like that. And then in January, just real quickly, I have invited an author, entrepreneur onto the show. I always like to get in other people's creative processes. So her name is Joanna Penn, and we'll be talking about the creative process as well as I figured with it being January, and if anybody out there wanted to start writing a book on art or their art or even a fiction book, that it would be a good time to have Joanna on and just kind of give us a little tour of the creation world, creation process there. So those are the upcoming shows. So the next one is, like I said, with Lori Putnam on November 11th.
Okay, thank you. Well, I guess we can go ahead and wrap this up for today. I just want to remind everyone that we will be putting this up on YouTube, and I'll put a note in the follow-up from GoToWebinar. They'll kick you a little automatic email, and that will have the link to our YouTube channel, or like I said, you can check artistnetwork.com/art-chat. And I want to thank Linda and Joe for joining us today, and do you have anything else before we go?
No, I think I'm good. Thank you all for listening. It was fun chatting with Linda, and I hope you enjoyed it and you were able to get something out of it.
All right. Well, thank you guys for being here, and thank you, Linda, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yep,
bye, everyone.
Good. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.